Hello and welcome to the second episode of Cover to Cover for 2021. Great to have you with us. I'm Joanne Joseph. We've got a really exciting show lined up today. We're talking about one of my favorite genres of literature, and that is autobiography, biography, and memoir. We're really lumping them together for the purpose of this episode. But there's some really fantastic books that are hitting the shelves right now, and you need to be aware of some of the most exciting writing in these genres. The first that I'm going to be tackling, a book that I'm going to be tackling, is 6 Years with Al-Qaeda by Stephen McGowan. Now, you may remember that he was taken a number of years ago by Al-Qaeda in November of the year 2009, the 11th of November, if I remember correctly. And of course, it made headlines all over the country. But what a traumatic few years it was for Stephen McGowan. And he actually joins me to speak about his latest book, The Story As Told, to Tudor Caradoc Davies. It is called 6 Years with Al-Qaeda. Lovely to have you with us, Stephen, and something of a miracle to actually have you with us.
Thanks, Joanne. Thanks for inviting me onto your show.
Well, thank you so much for being with me. I mean, I was fascinated by this book. It took me a little bit of time to get into it because, in a way, it really is such a schism, the place you were taken to, compared to our daily reality as South Africans.
That's for sure. I mean, you know, the edge of the Sahara, for starters, where I was actually kidnapped from, is already another world, looking onto these deserts. And we just drove further and further and further. On the day I was kidnapped, we just drove for 15 hours straight out, straight north, northeast into the Sahara. And it was literally another world. In fact, Al-Qaeda used to refer to it as an Akhir Kokob, which in Arabic means another planet. And it was another planet. I mean, everything you take for granted, everything that is your reality, is just, it's gone. They got most of the guys there thought the world was flat, which you only really read in history books. So it was unbelievable and incredibly long.
It's well, the great news, I suppose, and I'm saying that very flippantly, because 6 years is a huge amount of time, but the great news is that we managed to get you back onto South African soil. But I can't imagine, Steve, when I read this book and I stop to look at the details of your life there, what a deeply disorientating experience it must have been for you, amongst all the other emotions, fear, terror, you know, having to relearn yourself in that environment.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was between worlds at the time. I was between the UK and South Africa. So my wife and I were coming home to start a family. There was so much to look forward to, you know. Yeah. There were so many new, exciting adventures to come through. And I was living a small adventure, well, a big adventure, in a six-month time period that my wife allowed me.
Yeah.
And it's funny how I was riding through Mauritania, and there was a sandstorm going on, and there was these snakes slithering across, snakes like wind, snaky sand slithering across the road, and I was riding there, and it was hot, and I thought, wow, this for me is godforsaken land, you know, heaven forbid ever ending up here. And you would ever have guessed I'd spend the next 5 years, 8 months sitting in that. It was a interval in my life. You know, a six-year interval, which at the time, I was 36, so it was literally one-sixth of my life that I spent hanging out with Al-Qaeda in the Sahara.
Sure. Steve, give me a sense of this. I mean, the book details how radically this experience changed you. And how do you believe, looking back at it in retrospect, how do you believe it has changed you? In what ways has it changed you?
I would say the whole, you know, I do a few corporate talks, and everybody always asks me, if you could go back, would you change things? And that's an incredibly difficult question, and thank goodness you can't go back and change things, because that makes it easy. If I could take what I've learned from my time in the desert, and without the pain and the stress and the anguish for my friends and my family, and just take what I learned and apply, and, you know, and keep that and apply it to what I have now in life, it would have been an incredible university experience, to be honest. But unfortunately, it was 6 years, and there were people dying. There were people back home in Joburg wondering what was going on. My friends, my family, the government were involved. There was a lot of anguish. But I certainly believe I've come out a stronger person from all of this. I learned so many things, especially about myself, which I truly believe is the most important thing in life, actually, is to figure out what makes you tick, who you are. And at the time, I'd been working for about 13 years in corporate life, in banking. And, you know, it's a rat race. You are so busy. Every day is the same. And it's just, you're on the treadmill. And I believe the less time we have to actually realize what's important in life, and the less time we have to focus on people and family, is the more time we spend losing ourselves in the world. And my time in the desert, my rehab, yeah. if you like.
Yeah.
If they weren't going to kill me, I had to come out a stronger, better person. So I used my time in the desert to try and figure out what was important, to try and figure out what were my strong points, what were my weak points, what I wanted to spend more time doing, you know, when I was eventually released, if I was eventually released. But obviously, fortunately, we have survived thousands and thousands of years, so we are bred to survive. So fortunately, this did come to a close, and I came out with a story. And a lot of life lessons.
Steve, in terms of the life you left behind, you had your parents here, your mom was ailing. Sadly, she passed before you got back home. But your wife, Kathy, was also hanging on, waiting for you. What an emotional roller coaster this was for her. Give me a sense of how you repaired those relationships and made up for that lost time, if you were able to, when you got back.
Yes, it's difficult that, you know. I was living in a world in the Sahara. My family were living in a world back in the real world, and I had no idea what they were going through, and it took me months, if not years. In fact, writing of this book was one of the greatest therapies, because, and I know everyone says write a book, it's good therapy, but actually I refer to it as I had a big black sack over my shoulder, and every time I looked into the sack, there was nothing in there. And that was my understanding of what was going on back in South Africa. And the writing of this book has allowed me to literally take items and put them into my black sack. And my black sack has started to get color. I'm beginning to understand what my family went through. And yeah, I mean, they went through hell. My family went through absolute hell. And I've only been out the desert now 3 years, so I'm still piecing myself back together. And my family are well on the line of piecing themselves back together, but there certainly are some challenges that are still showing up. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the desert, I just had to survive.
Yeah.
I just had to survive. Keep my head on my shoulders. That was what I had to do. My wife was back here. She wanted children. She wanted to live life in the real world. She wanted a house, dogs, you know, to move on. And this got robbed from her. And people ask me, did I have a lot of guilt in the desert? But what happened to me was beyond my control, so I didn't have guilt from that perspective. Mm. But at the same time, I mean, I did basically put pause on my wife's life and my family's life. So we did go through a lot of difficult times. As far as putting it back together, I've realized what's important in life, and that's certainly family and friends and keeping a balanced life, keeping with exercise, you know, keep your mind active, keep human interaction, you know, keep it going. So I've really thrown myself back into my family, back into the real world, back into my exercise. I'd lost a lot of weight in the desert. I've subsequently put on about 9 kilograms since I came out, and I'm still below my weight pre-kidnapping. But it's about saturating yourself in what's important, and my wife and I are doing that, and we've got many friends, and, you know, we've got a great life, actually. We know what is important in life. So we have grown. We have both grown through these tricky times.
Yeah.
And better for it.
I want to quickly look at a video, a proof of life video that came through around about 2014. And this was when, I'm saying, it must have been nerve-wracking for your family. But even for members of the media like us who were tracking your story, members of the public who were hoping the best for you, these proof of life videos were what people clung to at that time.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you're looking surprisingly well in this video, but I can see a huge amount of underlying ocean, and I want our viewers to take a look at that video that came through in 2014.
Short message to the South African government. I thank you for your continued efforts in negotiating my release. My wife and my family, I am well. I hope you are all well back home. I understand that I may be seeing you soon. I believe that there is an organization involved now, a South African organization involved, brokering the release. I thank this organization. I thank this organization for everything, for bringing this to a close and having me home soon. I thank you.
So that was a proof of life video that reached us at that time. And watching it again this morning before our conversation with you today, you know, I can sense on the one hand there's a part of you that's very composed on the outside, but almost towards the end I've got a tear in my eye because I'm feeling some very deep emotion underneath that exterior.
It was difficult. That was December 2014. Yeah. So kidnapped in 2011. 2012 was just chaos. Al-Qaeda was getting stronger. 2013, the French arrived in Mali and they were just blowing everything up.
Yeah.
And we were running around the desert. 2014, we were just being chased by surveillance planes and there were Mirage aeroplanes flying overhead. Mm. And this was at the end of 2014. And I had made at this stage maybe 7 or 8 proof of life videos already. Prisoner relations was terrible. We had all really started to lose hope. The actual proof of lives were now further apart from each other. They weren't as regular. Yeah. Al-Qaeda didn't really care about us at this stage. We were purely just trying to avoid being found. And when I made this, and when I heard that there was a South African organization, not just a organization, but somebody, you know, who was my blood involved in this, it ran incredibly deep. I mean, wow, you could almost bring a lump to my throat talking about this conversation.
Yeah.
But, and this organization, Being Gift of the Givers, they actually stepped in and said that they were going to help Johan, the Swedish hostage. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, me being, because I had dual nationality, a British passport as well, I was the most likely to be killed. So I was always the favorite, but the most hated.
Yeah.
And at this point, I was the favorite, but from a positive point of view, because South Africa was the reason to get me out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I was told that within a month I should be home. Unfortunately, it didn't work, and I sat there another 2.5 years. But those proof of lives were always something I'd hold on to. It always made me remember that I was being remembered and that there was something going on behind the scenes.
You know what amazes me, Steve? I would have expected you to be gripped by some measure of hatred for Al-Qaeda. Some sort of, a desire for vengeance even. It's just completely absent from the book. Why is that? I mean, I was wondering at some point whether there's a measure of Stockholm syndrome there.
Yeah, everybody asks that, hey?
Yeah.
Look, I mean, I was a prisoner. I truly believe there's no Stockholm syndrome by the definition. I was there trying to survive and trying to get by, and I realized that hating people and, being the worst version of myself was not going to benefit anybody, actually. If anything, it would make Al-Qaeda more antagonistic, and there was more chance that I'd be beheaded. So actually, I needed to try and be a better version of myself. And at the end of the day, if they're not going to kill me, and if I ever do go home, well, I want to go home a complete person. I don't want to go home a complete wreck and burden my family further.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I mean, I'm not actually angry about the situation. And maybe people see me as a bit strange. Maybe there's still a few layers to shed before I understand this. But being angry is not going to help me. Being angry, Al-Qaeda don't care, and it'll only make me miserable. And every day it's going to affect my wife, it'll affect my family, affect my friends. It's not going to affect anybody else besides me. So really, that's the kind of stuff you've got to let go of.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it only takes you to a bad place.
Steve, that's a wonderful place at which to end our interview, because I think you also are sharing the story more publicly in these talks you're doing. Will you just give us quickly some of the details on that, should people want to call you in to expand on this?
Certainly, Joanne. So I've been very busy. Last year, people were comparing COVID lockdown with my 6 years in the desert.
Yeah.
And there were actually a few similarities. So I've been very busy. Last year, I was frantic with a lot of South African corporates. I've been doing talks in the US, talks in Singapore, Australia. Really, I suppose this specific talk is about resilience. And it's about just when you've got no hope, how do you find hope? And how do you get through on a daily basis? And really, it's about looking inside and making the best. I think there are many talks within my 6 years that can still come out of the desert. I mean, pick a topic. I can probably talk for about an hour on it.
Yeah.
But I'm enjoying it, and I'm really enjoying seeing the impact it has on people. You know, that such good stuff can come out of a difficult time is fantastic. And I'll continue doing it while there is relevance and while people enjoy it. So, yes, I'm doing lots of corporate talks.
Well, I'm glad to see you looking so much better, Stephen, having dealt with this experience in part. Yes. And thank you for sharing it with us. 6 years with Al-Qaeda, that story of Steve McGann, as told to Tudor Caradoc Davies. Look out for it at Exclusive Books. Right, we're going to move on to our next interview now. And this was an interview I did with Jonathan Jansen. He is, of course, the prestigious professor at Stellenbosch University. And he shared with me some insights into his latest book, which is Learning Lessons. And in this particular book, he focuses on all the people who've played a significant role in his life, building him into the well-recognized individual he is currently in society. I asked him specifically about whether he was being a little bit self-effacing by saying that these were the people who made the important difference in creating the man we now know as Jonathan Jansen.
I grew up with little, and in terms of material resources and support, my generation, as you know, was sort of first to go to university and all of that. So, when you reflect back, you realize that there were so many people in your life that put you on a different path to most of your friends, and who were smart. I mean, I had a lot of friends who were much smarter than me, I can assure you, and talented, and but they didn't do much with their lives. And that's not because I'm special. That's simply because I had parents who were deeply spiritual people. I never saw anything in our home that was violent or disruptive or anything like that, you know. They brought us up in a very strict, maybe too strict, evangelical church environment. And so there was a value system. That's the point. And then surrounding you were aunts and uncles and church people and so on, who kept pushing you, kept sliding a 10 rand, which was a lot of money then, into your pocket, and drove you to university when you had nothing, and so on. So I don't think this is false modesty, to be honest with you. It's just an enormous gratitude for the people who made it possible for me to do a few things in life.
So, Prof, it's interesting. I mean, some of those people were teachers, for example, and they were not just teachers at school. Later on, they turned out to be teachers at university, who had a huge impact on your life. Tell me a little bit more about that, about the importance of teachers who massively impacted your life.
Yeah, you know, again, when one looks back on your life, and particularly on your learning, you realize how incredibly important it is to have a teacher who says, I believe in you, you can do stuff. I read a report of my at high school the other day as I was unpacking boxes, and I saw this report by my biology teacher, you know, Mrs. Akuji, and in the report she says, and I got a B for biology or something, standard 8 or 9, I forget, and she said to me, this is okay, but you are not living up to your full potential. Now, you know, when you think about that, it's massive. A child doesn't need a lot to be motivated to learn. Just a teacher, another adult, you know, that says, I believe in you. And that's why so much of my life, wherever I've taught, even now at university, I literally call up students who get 79% and not 80% and say, I believe in you. They don't know me from bar soap. They fall off their chairs, you know, and now with COVID, they're surprised I got their cell phone numbers. And because that student will forget what I taught them about epistemology or politics or whatever, but they will remember that I called them to say they're good. And so I'm simply carrying this forward, you know, from enormously influential teachers. Also, as you said, at universities, both in South Africa and abroad, I was very lucky to have. Now, of course, you've got to show up. I mean, people don't say potential if you waste your time and so on and don't do work. And so there has to be signs of life on your part in order to also have this kind of affirmation from the people in your surroundings.
That's a hugely important point. You talk about your work with Oprah a little bit later on, and that's something that she says that makes a huge mark on you and a lot of sense to you as someone who showed up. And we've got many children and many young people in our country who came from much the same circumstances as you and who are finding it difficult to cope in these environments, either you know, upmarket or affluent schools, or their first experiences at university. I mean, how important is that notion of showing up once you're given the opportunity?
You know, I work with this notion of the straw that broke the camel's back, that often a student at school or university is going through so much. You don't see it. You know, we don't see it as teachers. But there's a broken home. There's no internet, you know, in the township. There's to continue online learning. There's no food sometimes, just to get from day one to day two. And now this kid comes to school. And if you have a teacher who is aggressive or a teacher who is dismissive or simply doesn't see them, that's the straw. That's the final thing, you know. And as you recall in the book, I had that experience at UWC where I just said, this is too much. And I just walked off campus, you know, and said, and looked for a job until somebody brought me back. So I'm very conscious of the fact that young people today, even now, I mean, think of it now with the pandemic, they're going through so much, you know, in life, in their life circumstances. And one thing, just a negative word, just a discouragement can break them and so on. So it is incredibly important. And so we talk so much as professors about the intellect, the cognitive and academic cognition, all of the stuff in your head. We don't talk enough about the stuff in your heart, the stuff that really gets you out of bed. Your brain doesn't get you out of bed in the morning. It's something deeper that you want to do and achieve that really gets you going. And as teachers, we have enormous power to make or break young people.
There's some profound thoughts as well about the kind of teacher that you wanted to become, because when you became a teacher, you did these very interesting site visits to children's homes. I've not heard of a teacher who's done that before. I had to stop and think about what it would take to go to each of those homes and to learn to understand the context of each of those children. Why was that important? Why was it important for you to do that?
Yeah, you know, I figured out fairly early on, I suppose, as a young teacher, that if I could know you, not just as the body in the desk in front of me, but in the context of your family, your domestic economics, your environment, you know, because I grew up in a very rough neighborhood, but I was protected, as I said, inside this very devout family structure. Then I might be able to teach you better. So I had that hunch. I didn't know for sure, but I had that hunch. And so I started to visit these kids, you know, in their homes. Oh, my word, Joanne. I mean, as you saw in the book, you start to teach differently. You start to love differently. You start to be sensitive to the child that you know probably didn't eat last night, but you also come down hard on the kid. I remember one student in particular who had, you know, those days, stereo sets in his room and all kinds of gadgets, you know, up in Bukop in Cape Town. And I said to myself, this is a spoiled brat, you know. He's got so much going for him, and yet he's cruising through life. So I put huge pressure on him, and guess what? He became a teacher himself, and I see him from time to time, and so on. So you sort of modulate, I suppose, your responses to different kids, given what you know about them. But any teacher that thinks they can be effective simply by showing up in their classroom without knowing anything about the road traveled by that young person, I think they're misguided. You need to know them. And by the way, it's also lekker, you know, it's also nice. It's really, I mean, just imagine, you know, now with COVID, this has been the first time for most teachers that they were forced to work with parents. Because when they send work home, they, especially in the younger classes, you needed to make sure that that parent was able to teach in your absence, so to speak. You know, so I'm reading a lot of those stories for a new book we have called Teaching in Pandemic Times and so on. But we don't need to wait for a pandemic to do. You know, now, of course, today, I don't know, maybe it's just the kind of thing older teachers like myself say, but I don't see that common sense, because people are more likely to complain about their salaries than to really get down and dirty with the reality of our children's lives. So I encourage, when I train teachers, like last year at Stellenbosch University, I tell them, your effectiveness depends on whether you, for your homeroom class at least, that you visit every child in their home, you'll be a much better teacher.
Prof, some interesting thoughts on this notion, you are smarter than you think. And you've compared the American university system, where professors are, or lecturers are far more likely to adopt that kind of approach to teaching than South African universities, where much of the time students are being set up to fail.
You know, you can talk to any South African who did their postgraduate studies in the United States. I can't speak for the UK, but I know the US very well. And they will tell you the first thing that hits you is the expectation that you are going to excel, the expectation that you're going to be good. You know, every American parent tells their kids, you know, you're going to be the next president. Now, it's not true, but it's the message
of aspiration. It's the message that you can. I grew up in an environment, I had some uncles, to be honest with you, who used to tell me, we love you very much, but, you know, you're a dog corp. You're not going anywhere, you know. It was in primary school. So our system is geared to press people down, to tell kids. I mean, I'm sure this might have happened to you when you went to university, Jan, that there was at least one class where the professor said, you know, look to your left, look to your right. By the end of the first semester, half of you are going to be gone. Do you know that still happens? How on earth can you tell people? They're not going to make it before they even got going, you know. So there's something in our culture, our academic culture, that is quite pernicious, you know, and needn't be so. You know, and so on. So I know, and I spent a big chunk of my time even meeting random people, like the guy who puts the petrol in my car. And I talk to them about studies. I talk to them about what are you going to do next. I ran into trouble once in Bloemfontein where I asked the petrol jockey and I said, you know, you don't have your matric yet, you know. Wouldn't you rather have a degree? I'll never forget what he said. He said, I'd rather have Jesus. Well, I have to tell you, I had no comeback for that.
Prof, it's always great speaking to you. And I want to thank you so much for making the time to speak to me today. And I wish we could have spent more time together because this is just such an outstanding book, particularly if you're interested in education. I want to thank you so much for your time today. Thank you, Professor Jonathan Jansen.
Welcome. Good luck.
So that was my conversation with Professor Jonathan Jansen, distinguished professor at Stellenbosch University. You really want to get a hold of that book, Learning Lessons, a really good read. We're focusing now on two other intriguing books which fall under the genre of autobiography and biography. And joining me right now is Obenawa Amponsa. She is a very skilled executive coach. She's a facilitator. She's also a PhD candidate looking at African literature. And one of these books is a focus of her studies. Obenawa, so fantastic to be with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a great pleasure because I can't wait to delve into this book, Beauty of the Heart, with you. That's the first one. Of course, Promise Me, Dad. That is the second one. That is the Joe Biden autobiography, I should say. But let's start with Beauty of the Heart, homegrown writing mm-hmm. by the very well-known South African journalist, Zubeda Jaffa. Tell me what this book is about. Focuses very much on Charlotte Makeke.
Absolutely. You know, Charlotte Makeke is one of the unsung heroes, really, of South Africa's liberation story, but also of Pan-Africanism globally. Many people will know her as the first Black South African woman to graduate from university. But what they might not be as aware of is the time that she spent as a performer in a choir where she traveled to the UK. And as part of that, really helped to challenge anti-Black racism there and stereotypes of what it meant to be Africans. This choir then moved on to North America, where they came into contact with the AME Church, which is, of course, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. She ended up gaining admission to Wilberforce University as a result of a scholarship from them and came to know W.E.B. Du Bois quite well. She then returned home to South Africa, having graduated, and began her career as a teacher, but did so much community work, really uplifting and inspiring those around her, and as many people will know, was responsible for the formation of what later became the ANC's Women's League. So she had quite an indelible contribution to South Africa's liberation struggle.
So it's an important one because, of course, the ANC is calling for 2021 to be called this year of Charlotte Makeke. I was dismayed, though, a few years ago in my daughter wanted to do a project on Charlotte Makeke's life. The information out there, there was no body of information that really existed on her life. This book takes an important step into that reference category, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, if you Google her, you get a bit in U.S. archives, you get some in Pan-African archives, but there's no place really that you can go for a detailed biography, or bibliography rather, of additional sources. So there are a number of theses that have been done, there are a number of reports that have been done, a number of places where we can begin to piece together her life. Beauty of the Heart brings many of these sources into one place, and is a great beginning point for someone who's looking to delve into her life and story more deeply.
So that's certainly a very, very important book to get your hands on if you want to know that important part of African feminist history. Let's move abroad right now to the United States. Joe Biden, the new American American president. This very moving book that I saw him speak about on CNN a few weeks ago, that was the first interview with Anderson Cooper where I really saw him open up and speak about something that was so deeply personal to him. Yes. What is Promise Me Dad actually about?
You know, Promise Me Dad is Joe Biden's story of really his last year with his son, Beau, who died of brain cancer, just as he was deciding whether or not to run for president in 2016. And I think it's a fascinating book for a number of reasons. The first is that I think just memoir, you know, autobiography is interesting. Yeah. What do you leave in? What do you include? What stories do you tell? Who do you highlight? Who do you not?
Absolutely.
And it became very clear in this book that Joe Biden first and foremost sees himself as a father, a grandfather, a family man. But it also became clear through this book that he was really looking to cement his legacy. You know, he wrote this just after Donald Trump would have been elected and would have first taken office. And in many ways, it's interesting that already at that early stage, he kind of set himself up as the antithesis of Trump. You know, a family man, he speaks about being someone of moderate means. He speaks about what it is to know the pain of losing a child. And unfortunately, that's a loss that many people can relate to, particularly in this last year of COVID. So it certainly humanizes him and begins to give us a look into what he would like his legacy to be moving forward.
So that's interesting for all sorts of reasons. Would you say it's a good introduction to Joe Biden as he takes over the presidency?
I think it is a good introduction to Joe Biden. I think it's a good introduction because it certainly speaks to his interest in foreign affairs. It gives some of an overview of his time as a U.S. senator. He served for many decades. And it also gives some insight into what he might be like as a president. And in fact, having read this book, I do now understand Joe Biden a little bit more. You know, here's someone who's certainly open to listening and being persuaded, but he's not exactly going to be at the vanguard of liberation, right?
Yeah.
He's not exactly going to be the one to lead the charge, but he is someone who can be brought along, and we've already begun to see that in terms of his presidency. But again, it is interesting because this is his story about himself, and there are very few of us, if any, that can be entirely neutral about ourselves.
True, absolutely. Benoit, well, thank you for those fine reviews of those two books. So much more coming out in the next few months that we'll be able to tell you about that fall into those genres squarely as well. But look out for those two books. Promise Me Dad was the last one Benoit spoke about there. It is, of course, Joe Biden's memoir. And tells that very personal story of the loss of his son. It wasn't the first loss he experienced, as you may well know, having lost family members in a motor car accident a little bit before that. But I think it gives a very personal insight into a man we only know one facet of from a political point of view. Beauty of the Heart by Zubeda Jaffa, and hopefully we're going to see that on the shelves in the near future. But you can go directly to www.exclusivebooks.co.za. That is where you can find both of these books online. If you still a little bit hesitant about going into store with COVID on the go at the moment. So that's one way you can source these books. Certainly the Zubeda Jaffa book will be available online in the next few weeks. And of course, Promise Me Dad, both available online and in your exclusive books store. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Cover to Cover. You see, this McKeyser will have the next episode for you. Looking forward to seeing you again soon. Take care. Happy reading.